Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Numbers chapter 35. I'm going to do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 34. We'll talk about cities for the Levites and six particular Levitical cities, the cities of refuge for the manslayer. Our context is this. In chapter 34, we looked at the boundaries of the tribes as they were laid out, both for the whole nation of Israel and also for the individual tribes. So now, starting in chapter 35, verses 1 through 3, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho, saying, Command the sons of Israel that they give to the Levites from the inheritance of their possession cities to live in, and you shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the cities. The cities shall be theirs to live in, and their pasture land shall be for their cattle and for their herds and for all their beasts." Now, Moses is here in the plains of Moab. We've been there for quite a while. We had the story of Balak calling Balaam down there to curse Israel. We had the story of the Midianite and Moabite women seducing the Israelites to idolatry by religious prostitution. We had the destruction of, the bad defeat of the Midianites by the Israelites. All of that has happened in the last several chapters, and that's still all in the plains of Moab, which is in the Transjordan area, east of Jordan, north, right to the north of the Dead Sea. So now in verse 2, we turn to the provision for the Levites. Remember, they did not have a tribal allotment of land like all the other 11 tribes. They got cities instead and pasture lands around the cities. We read in Numbers 1, 47 through 49, the prohibition on the Levites receiving an inheritance in land. The Levites, however, were not numbered among them by their father's tribe. For the Lord had spoken to Moses, saying, "Only the tribe of Levi you shall not number, nor shall you take their census among the sons of Israel." They weren't numbered because they weren't going to fight in the military, and because they weren't going to receive an allotment of land. They received cities instead. As the NIV Study Bible points out, these cities were scattered all over Israel. And we can go to Joshua 21 and read more about these cities, which we'll do when we get there to Joshua. Chai Gill says that it was not proper that the Levites would always be camped out around the tabernacle. As you recall in the earlier chapters of Numbers, that the Levites, when the Israel was camped, the tabernacle was in the center of the camp, and then the Levites were directly around the tabernacle to protect it. Well, that was only for marching through the wilderness. When they actually settled in the land, that wouldn't be. They needed to spread out, and they did. Now, pasture lands of verse 2 were given in addition to the cities. Why? Because the Levites couldn't live without this. There's no room to plant crops in the city. This was an agricultural society. They needed the pasture land for their crops. So now we go to Numbers 35, verses 4 through 5. "The pasture lands of the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall extend from the wall of the city outward 1,000 cubits around. You shall also measure outside the city on the east side 2,000 cubits, and on the south side 2,000 cubits, and on the west side 2,000 cubits, and on the north side 2,000 cubits, with the city in the center. This shall become theirs as pasture lands for the cities." Well, immediately we notice a problem here. In verse 4, it says there's 1,000 cubits around the city for the Levites, and then it says in verse 5 that there's 2,000 cubits around the city. Now, how do we reconcile this apparent discrepancy? Well, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown reconciles it this way. This is the way I instinctively did it also. There's a total of 3,000 cubits on each side. The 2,000 cubits began where the 1,000 cubits left off. Now, John Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest this. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the outer 2,000 cubits was for common pasture land where the beast of the flock and the herd could chew grass. And then the closer in 1,000 cubits between the wall and the pasture land was probably for accommodations for agricultural workers, gardens, vineyards, olive gardens, that kind of thing. And that makes a lot of sense. Gill and Clark say the same thing, except they reverse the order. They say the 1,000 cubits was for the flocks to eat, and the outward 2,000 cubits were for the agricultural workers, the gardens, the vineyards, and olive gardens. I don't think that's right. I think it makes more sense to have more land for the sheep and the goats and the cows. Now, some people have suggested that the 1,000 cubits and should be the same as the 2,000 cubits because of textual reasons. Adam Clark disagrees with this. The Septuagint actually has both measures as 2,000. there'll be 2,000 cubits around. Verse 4, verse 5, there'll be 2,000 cubits around. That gets rid of the discrepancy, but as Adam Clark points out, there is no manuscript evidence to show that the numbers are similar. So we're going to take it as 1,000 plus 2,000 for different purposes around the Levitical cities. We go down to Numbers 35, verses 6 through 8. The cities which you shall give to the Levites shall be the six cities of refuge, which you shall give for the manslayer to flee to. And in addition to them, you shall give 42 cities. All the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall be 48 cities, together with their pasture lands. As for the cities which you shall give for the possession of the sons of Israel, you shall take more from the larger, and you shall take less from the smaller. Each shall give some of his cities to the Levites in proportion to his possession, which he inherits. Now these cities of refuge, they're refuge for the manslayer to flee in. We'll talk all about that in just a minute. But these cities of refuge were placed strategically. Three were in the Transjordan area, and three were in Canaan proper. I've got a map showing that. Let's look at west of the Jordan River, starting at Kadesh, famous ancient city up there in Kadesh, which is just to the northwest of Lake Hula, which is the little body of water just to the north of the Sea of Galilee. So Kadesh in the northwest, and in the central west is Shechem, famous city where Abraham first went into the promised land, and so forth, where Mount Ebal and Gerizim were. And then we go down to the south, Hebron, which is about halfway down south from the northern tip of the Dead Sea, famous Hebron, where all the ancestors were buried. So Kadesh, Shechem, and Hebron were the cities of refuge west of the Jordan and east of the Jordan. We've got the city of Golan, which is dead east of the Sea of Galilee. That's why today they call it the Golan Heights. And then you go south a little bit in present-day Jordan is Ramoth-Gilead. And then you go down to the plains of Moab, where Moses is now, and you got the city of Bezer. So Golan, Ramoth-Gilead, and Bezer are the cities of refuge to the east of the Jordan. Six of them, plus 42 others. All of these cities of refuge were Levitical cities, which I think makes sense because the Levites are going to be doing some judicial work trying to decide whether somebody's a manslayer or not who's fled to the city. Now, as for the 48 cities, the bigger tribes gave more cities than the smaller tribes to make the sacrifice equal, to make the sacrifice in proportion, as it says in verse 8. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the cities of refuge. Well, let's talk about the proportional distribution now. Judah and Simeon gave 9 cities. Now, Simeon is enclosed within Judah's borders, if you recall, either scattered or concentrated. And so those two tribes gave 9 cities, and the other tribes only gave 4 cities each. So that's how they made equal the distribution of Levitical cities. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the cities of refuge. We see a description of these cities in Joshua 20, which we'll get to when we get there. John Gill points out that the surrounding nations also had cities of refuge, but they were different than the Jewish cities of refuge because they gave refuge to any kinds of criminal, a rapist, a murderer. We'll see here that that doesn't apply to Jewish cities of refuge. They only gave refuge to unintentional killers, manslayers. We read about the cities in Deuteronomy 19:3, the cities of refuge. You shall prepare the roads for yourself and divide into 3 parts the territory of your land, which the Lord your God will give you as a possession, so that any manslayer may flee there. Now, the 3 parts there, I'm assuming, are the 3 cities on the west side, Kadesh, Shechem, and Hebron. Although Jameson Fawcett and Brown says that these 3 parts that are mentioned in Deuteronomy 19:3 is the whole country, east and west, divided into 3 parts as you go from north to south. In other words, east and west are held together in one part at the north, and then east and west in one part in the center, and then east and west in one part in the south. I don't know, it doesn't matter, but the point is they were equally distributed geographically so that anybody that accidentally or negligently kills somebody, he would have a shot at getting to the city of refuge before the Avenger of Blood got a hold of him. Now, of course, back then, if you kill somebody in the family, your family members went and took care of the justice. There was no public court system, so to speak, for this sort of thing. The private Avengers of Blood went after the killer, the person committing the homicide. Now, these cities of refuge gave the Avenger of Blood time to cool off, because if a manslayer could get to the city, the Avenger of Blood, the kinsman of the deceased, might think, well, he didn't really mean to do it. The axe head flew accidentally off his head. Maybe I shouldn't kill him. And so, as the manslayer stays in the city of refuge, safe and secure, the avenger might say, well, you know, there's no need to avenge this. I'm going to let it go. This is John Gill's idea. I think that makes a lot of sense. Why were the Levites in charge of these Levitical cities of refuge? As I said earlier, they were the most suitable and impartial judges. They might be able to still the passions of the blood avenger. Now, Adam Clark makes the point that nowhere do we see that the cities of refuge were abused. In other words, I kill somebody and I run to the city of refuge and I'm safe and I get away with murder. No, that's not going to happen. We'll see later their actual trials. If you end up in a city of refuge, it's not automatic. You've got to go through a trial to prove that you didn't intentionally kill the deceased. Clark also points out that nowhere do we read that the cities of refuge were inefficient. In other words, that they didn't work. This was a functioning legal system that worked. Now, verse 6 refers to a manslayer. You shall give to the Levite 6 cities of refuge, which you shall give for the manslayer to flee to. That's a technical legal term. We still use it in our modern law. A manslayer is somebody who kills somebody, but not intentionally, not by lying in wait with premeditated malice aforethought, as the lawyers say now. We go down to Numbers 35, verses 9 through 15. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall select for yourselves cities to be your cities of refuge, that the manslayer who has killed any person unintentionally may flee there. The city shall be to you as a refuge from the avenger, so that the manslayer will not die until he stands before the congregation for trial. That's important. He does have to stand a trial once he gets there. Verse 13, the cities which you are to give shall be your 6 cities of refuge. You shall give 3 cities across the Jordan, that's to the east of the Jordan, and 3 cities in the land of Canaan, that's to the west of the Jordan. They are to be cities of refuge. These 6 cities shall be for refuge for the sons of Israel, and for the alien, and for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person unintentionally may flee there. Notice the alien and the sojourner. Those would be the proselytes of the gate and proselytes of the righteousness, people who are in Israel for business, proselytes of the gate, proselytes of righteousness, those who have become circumcised and have started following the law of Moses. They're not true Israelites yet, but they're kind of getting there, moving that way. Well, they have a chance for the cities of refuge too. Now, in verse 12, as I pointed out, the manslayer will not die once he reaches the city of refuge until he stands before the congregation for trial. NASB has congregation, the Holman Christian Study Bible has assembly, that's a court. Now there's a difference of opinion as to which court tried the case. Here are 2 options. It could be the court where the killing was committed. Option number 2 is it could be the court in the city of refuge. We're going to see later that it's going to sound like it's the court in which the killing was committed, but I'll leave it open for right now. But this verse 12 shows that in which it says that the manslayer must stand before the congregation. This shows that the city of refuge was not a permanent refuge. The manslayer had to go to trial. He couldn't just run to the city and say, nah, 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 you can't get me. No, sir. He has to be tried. Now, the law later on in Deuteronomy 19, 8 through 9 said that if Israel was expanded, it was to set up 3 more cities of refuge. Deuteronomy 19:8, if the Lord your God enlarges your territory, just as he has sworn to your fathers, and gives you all the land which he promised to give to your fathers, if you carefully observe all this commandment which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to walk in his ways also, always, then you shall add 3 more cities for yourself besides these 3. So this was an important legal provision that was going to be in effect even as Israel expanded. Now, there were 3 cities to the west and 3 cities to the east. The question might arise, well, why are there just as many cities for 2.5 tribes on the east as there were for 9.5 tribes in Canaan? That doesn't make it balanced. Well, the answer to that is that manslayers on the west could cross over and use cities on the east just as well. So that's not going to overload the court system in the west. We turn now to Numbers 35, verses 16 through 21. If anyone strikes a person with an iron object and death results, he is a murderer. The murderer must be put to death. If a man has in his hand a stone capable of causing death and strikes another person and he dies, the murderer must be put to death. If a man has in his hand a wooden object capable of causing death and strikes another person and he dies, the murderer must be put to death. The avenger of blood himself is to kill the murderer. When he finds him, he is to kill him. Likewise, if anyone in hatred pushes a person or throws an object at him with malicious intent and he dies, or if in hostility he strikes him with his hand and he dies, the one who struck him must be put to death. He is a murderer. The avenger of blood is to kill the murderer when he finds him. And of course, that means in the city or outside of the city of refuge. It doesn't matter, because cities of refuge are not for murderers. They're for manslayers. Now, these verses describe an intentional killing, a murder as opposed to a manslaughter. Because if you strike a person with an iron object, well, that's pretty intentional, is it not? And likewise, if you strike him with a stone, that's intentional. If you strike him with a wooden object, it's intentional. The law just gives three examples of intentional murder here. Verse 19, it says, the avenger of blood himself is to kill the murderer, is to kill. This is not an option. It must be carried out, because a murderer is not allowed to live, because his blood is polluted. The blood of his victim has polluted the land. So all this means that there are no cities of refuge for willful murderers. Verse 19 says that when he, the avenger of blood, finds him, the murderer, he, the avenger of blood, is to kill him. That means that even if the avenger of blood finds the murderer in the city of refuge, lights out for the murderer. Even in the city of refuge, the blood avenger can kill the murderer. We go down to Numbers 35, verses 22 through 29. But if anyone suddenly pushes a person without hostility or throws any object at him without malicious intent or without looking, drops a stone that could kill a person and he dies, but he was not his enemy and wasn't trying to harm him, the assembly is to judge between the slayer and the avenger of blood according to these ordinances. The assembly is to protect the one who kills someone from the hand of the avenger of blood. Then the assembly will return him to the city of refuge he fled to, and he must live there until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. If the one who kills someone ever goes outside the border of the city of refuge he fled to, and the avenger of blood finds him outside the border of his city of refuge and kills him, the avenger will not be guilty of bloodshed, for the one who killed a person was supposed to live in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. Only after the death of the high priest may the one who has killed a person return to the land he possesses. These instructions will be a statutory ordinance for you throughout your generations wherever you live. So verse 22 is talking about someone who kills somebody else without malicious intent. That means without premeditation, without malice of thought, without lying in wait, as NASB has it. The NIV simply puts it unintentionally. That can happen either through negligence or accident. Verse 23 says, if someone throws an object, without looking, drops a stone that could kill a person. In other words, he's working on top of a building and he drops a stone off the top. He just throws it over the side without looking. Somebody's walking underneath. Bam, he kills him. Well, that's not a murder. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about the difference between negligent homicides and accidental homicides. There is a difference. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But right now, the major distinction is between intentional murder and unintentional manslaughter. The cities of refuge were only for unintentional manslaughter. I said this before, I'll say it again. Verse 24, the assembly is to judge between the slayer and the avenger of blood. In other words, the manslayer, having fled to the city of refuge, has still got to undergo a trial. The avenger of blood shows up, says, I want to take this guy to court. He killed my relative. And so the Levites say, okay, we're going to have a court hearing here, and we're going to see, was this an intentional murder, or was it a manslaughter, a case of manslaughter? So that shows that murderers could not just come into the city of refuge willy-nilly. He had to undergo a trial. And even a manslayer had to prove his case. If he accidentally or negligently kills someone, he still got to prove his case, or he's subject to being executed by the avenger of blood. Now, verse 25 says, then the assembly will return him, the manslayer, or the alleged manslayer, will return him to the city of refuge he fled to. Well, that is the manslayer. The manslayer will be returned to the city of refuge he fled to. Why did he leave the city of refuge? He's fled to the city of refuge to be safe, and now he's going to be returned to the city of refuge? Well, from that we can deduce that the trial was actually held not in the city of refuge, but in the city where the killing took place. as John Gill points out. Now, if that's the case, that completely vitiates what I said about the Levites would be the best people to judge a crime of manslaughter versus murder, because the crime would not be taking place in the city of refuge. So, my bad on that. Just forget I ever said that. Now, the manslayer's got to stay in the city of refuge. He's been exonerated by the court, but he's got to stay in the city of refuge, which is not his home city. He's got to stay there until the high priest dies and a new high priest takes up. And that can be for a long time, depending on how young the high priest is. So that means the manslayer is indeed punished. He's exiled from his home tribe. Now, a manslayer might not deserve capital punishment, but he does deserve punishment. At least in the case of negligence, he deserves punishment. Maybe not in the case of accident, but most manslaughter cases are not accidents. If you throw a stone off a building and you drop it on somebody, that's generally negligence, because you ought to look before you throw the stone off the top of a roof. In fact, I remember reading a case in law school where somebody who grossly negligently dropped a stone off a skyscraper, not a stone, but a building block off the top of a tall skyscraper without looking, he was subject to second-degree murder charges. Because even though it was not intentional, it was so grossly negligent, it was considered to be intentional. Now, this sort of detail is not in the law, not in the Old Testament law here. But my point is that, yeah, accidents do occur, but in an accident, unfortunately, kills somebody. Well, the person who caused the accident is going to have to suffer a little bit. He's going to have to be exiled, whether he was negligent or not. Now, this, of course, would make people be very, very careful, less likely to have accidents and less likely to commit negligence. John Gill agrees with me here. He says this being exiled until the death of the high priest in the city of refuge was a punishment for a negligent killing, which seems just. I mean, after all, our law today doesn't allow a manslaughter to go unpunished. It will allow somebody who just has an accident. That person is not punished. But if, like I say, most cases of accidental killing are cases of negligence, not pure accident. Now, the manslayer's got to stay in the city of refuge within the border around the city, as it says in verse 26. If he ever goes outside the border, then the avenger of blood can get him. That would include the 3,000 cubits of rural ground around each city, so it's not like he's trapped in the city. And this law would be in effect for all your generations. As it says in verse 29, of course, that means all the generations that they lived in Canaan. Of course, that went away with after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Actually, it went away in the destruction of Jerusalem by Babylon in 586 BC, but they came back. It's not in effect today, is what I'm saying. We go down to Numbers 35:30. If anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death at the evidence of witnesses, but no person shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness. All right, at this trial, whether it's in the city of refuge or most probably back where the crime was committed, a murderer can be put to death, but not with one witness. This is an evidentiary prescription. This is to keep innocent people from being condemned, as the NIV Study Bible says. Famous legal provision that this is. This famous legal provision is given in Deuteronomy 19:15. A single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he has committed. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed. Now, how many times is that quoted in the New Testament? I don't have cites here, but just from my memory, there's lots and lots of times that's cited. And, of course, that's good. You don't want to kill somebody with just one witness. That one witness may have made a mistake. And verse 30 says, if anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death. This, again, is to show that, no, we're not allowing the cities of refuge to be refuge for murderers, only for manslaughterers. We go down to Numbers 35, verses 31 and 32. Moreover, you shall not take ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall be surely put to death. Let me just take one verse at a time here. This is ransom for the life of a murderer. I can see this happening now. The murderer says, you know, I don't want to die, so I will pay you, the survivors of the deceased victim, the surviving family members, I will pay you a lot of money if you will just let me off and don't prosecute my case in court. Nope, that's not allowed, because a murderer is going to have to die. Verse 32 says, you shall not take ransom for him who has fled to his city of refuge. Now, this is talking about the manslaughterer. Verse 34 is talking about no ransom for murderers. Verse 31 is no ransom for murderers. And verse 32 is no ransom for manslayers. You shall not take ransom for him who has fled to his city of refuge, that he may return to live in the land before the death of the priest. I can see the manslaughter saying, oh, I don't like living in this city of refuge. I want to go home. I'm homesick. I tell you what, family members of my deceased victim, let me pay you some money, and then you will let me go back to my hometown without killing me. Nope, law doesn't allow that. We go now to verses 33 and 34, and we'll finish up this chapter. So you shall not pollute the land in which you are, for blood pollutes the land, and no expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. You shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel. Now this is interesting. Verse 33 says that the land is guilty just like the murderer is. No expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it. No expiation. It sounds like guilt. So the land is even guilty if you don't punish the murderer or the manslayer. God was very serious about capital punishment of murderers, and he was very serious about the punishment of manslayers by making them stay in exile in the city of refuge. These are judicial acts. These are not options. These are commands. No expiation can be made for the land that has innocent blood shed on that land, except one way. You can expiate that pollution, that sin, or that crime. You can expiate it by the blood of him who shed it. In other words, by the blood of the manslayer, or by the land of the murderer, by the blood of the murderer. You got to take that blood, or else the land's guilty. Verse 34, you shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel. The Lord of the universe is not going to live in a land polluted by blood. He says, in the midst of which I dwell here, in the midst, in the tabernacle, of course, in the Holy of Holies, above the tabernacle, with the Shekinah glory. I'm living here, and you've made the land polluted by murder? That's not going to happen. You expiate the blood. You execute judgment on the manslayer and on the murderer. Ladies and gentlemen, with those harsh judicial provisions, which are absolutely necessary for justice and for the maintenance of a decent society, we are finished with chapter 35 of Numbers. That prepares us to enter into the last chapter of Numbers, Numbers 36, verses 1 through 13. We will talk about the marriage of female heirs. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.